You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 259, Exodus 2, 11-25. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. How you doing, sir?
Well, Trey, my car died. It's not going to be like a country music song, you know.
And I was asking you if you believed in spiritual attacks before the show, because I have a car that's down too. So somebody or something out there is attacking our vehicle.
Yeah, well, they fired and missed you and got me.
So. Well, they got both of us.
Yeah. But we so. Yeah. So, hat over my heart, you know, we had to say goodbye to our minivan. So yeah.
Just long walks now or?
No, it's back to the bus. I mean, I can work a lot from home, but you know, when I got to go in, it's bus time. So I did that for a couple of years. So
yeah,
you know,
a good bus
we'll be fine. Yeah. Yeah. That's good. I just live 10 minutes from any bus stop. So I got to have somebody drop me off at the bus stop. But then I'm good, you know, drop me off, pick me up at the bus stop, and it's fine.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, we didn't talk about the Super Bowl last time. What's your thoughts on how the Super Bowl went?
What a boring game. You know how boring this was? Okay, without giving any names out here, I have, you know, I do these Memra courses online, and I have an NFL Hall of Famer taking the Hebrew course. And I recognized him by his email address and then reached out to this guy. Are you this guy? And he said, yep. You know, so he played for the Patriots back in the day. And so when the Patriots won, you know, I shot him a little email and said, hey, congratulations. You know, I bet this was, you know, exciting. And he goes, I didn't even watch the game. He goes, it sounds like I didn't miss much. I'm like, yes, opinion confirmed. You did not miss much.
Well, I enjoyed it. I liked it. Defense showed up. They punched each other in the mouth, and it was fun to watch.
Oh, man.
Yeah. That's off to New England again. So
it's just punting. You know, I was hoping the punter would get the most valuable player. Yeah. You know, what I was really hoping for was a Stranger Things trailer, but didn't even get that.
You know, several more months, but it's coming. Yep.
So now I'm in the dead zone. The dead zone until baseball starts. I don't watch basketball. I don't watch hockey.
You've got to get March Madness. You've got to get into March Madness.
Just it's the dead zone. You know, what can I say?
I hear you. Well, that's why people have this podcast, right? To fill the void.
That's why I have this podcast. Right. Oh, man. It's just trudging toward MLB, you know, March 20th, you know, the couple games in Japan, and then the rest of the teams start the next week. So I got to make it. Got to make it.
I hear you. Well, I guess we wrapped up chapter 2 this week.
Yeah, we'll get through chapter 2. So we're in Exodus 2, 11-25. That is the remainder of chapter 2 today. And a couple of things, again, to park on in the course of this episode. But let's just start by reading the chapter, just so it's in the heads of those listening. This is when Moses flees to Midian. That's the episode, the series of events in which we are falling. So one day, verse 11, when Moses had grown up, he went out to his people and looked on their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people. He looked this way and that, and seeing no one, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. When he went out the next day, behold, two Hebrews were struggling together. And he said to the man in the wrong, why do you strike your companion? He answered, who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? Then Moses was afraid and thought, surely the thing is known. When Pharaoh heard it, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and stayed in the land of Midian. And he sat down by a well. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters. And they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. The shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and saved them and watered their flock. When they came home to their father, Reuel, he said, how is it that you have come home so soon today? they said, "An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and even drew water for us and watered the flock." He said to his daughters, "Then where is he? Why have you left the man? Call him that he may eat bread." And Moses was content to dwell with the man. And he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah. She gave birth to a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, "I have been a sojourner in a foreign land." During those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. So that is the remainder of Exodus chapter 2. And again, as is our pattern, just some things of interest in the passage. I'm not going to sort of rehearse the passage back to you. It's, most of it is pretty self-evident as to what happens. But there are some things, as usual, you know, going on under the surface. And then there's a few stopping points that really deserve some attention. And the first one of these is in verse, 15. And that is when Moses flees Pharaoh and stays in the land of Midian. So what in the world is the land of Midian is the obvious question. And it's actually a more important question than we might realize, because it's going to take us into other areas as we proceed through the book of Exodus, a few other really important topics. And now, again, it just doesn't seem like it's much more than trivial, but trust me, I think you'll see why it's not in a moment. I'm going to start here with Sarna in his Exodus commentary. He has a few things to say about this. He says, "Moses is now an outcast fleeing for his life. The land of Midian, where he takes refuge, refers to an area under the control of one or more of the five semi-nomadic tribes that, according to biblical sources, make up the Midianite Confederation." And he cites a few passages here. Numbers 31:8 says, "They killed the kings of Midian." So notice the plural there, the kings of Midian. So it's more than one person. "With the rest of their slain, Evi, Rechem, Zor, Hor, and Rivah, the five kings of Midian. And they also killed Balaam, the son of Beor, with the sword." So Numbers 31:8 alludes to, again, this idea of a confederation of kings, of rulers, that are, all sort of operating under the rubric, of Midian. So Midian is going to be a place where there's, again, more than one domain, more than one ruler. It's going to be this tribal confederation kind of thing. Joshua 13:21 says, or refers to all the cities of the tableland and all the kingdom of Sihon, or Sion, king of the Amorites, who reigned in Heshbon, whom Moses defeated with the leaders of Midian. Again, leaders, plural. Evi and Rechem and Sor and Hur and the Rivah, the princes of Sihon who lived in the land. Again, this is interesting because here we have the Midianite kings, Midianite rulers is probably a better way to say this, in the time of Joshua, under the authority, or some sort of lordship, confederation, that Sihon of Og, had control over. Of course, he's one of the Amorite kings. That gets us into the Rephaim with the giant clan material. Here they're referred to as princes of Sihon, who lived in the land. So, this is the time of Joshua. I mean, this is going to be some years removed, obviously, from when Moses, wanders into the land of Midian. But again, for our purposes here, it's like, okay, this is some definable, or probably maybe a little bit fuzzy, region of land. It has five rulers in it. Again, it's this confederation idea. And it is interesting, again, that, Moses winds up here, and later this region is going to become, infamous because of its association in some way with Sihon of Og, again, this king of the Amorites. Now, if you remember, in Deuteronomy 2 and 3, this is the area of Bashan. Well, Midian is considerably south of that. So how to reconcile these two things? Again, it's a little bit far afield from what we're doing right now. It could be that Sihon, again, had sort of an extended, oversight, or had control over, maybe by tribute, maybe a vassal arrangement with Midian, that these princes of Midian were somehow under his authority. This isn't necessarily giant clan territory in Midian, but it has some relationship to what's going on there, again, as that we're going to read about much later. So that is a point of interest. Sarna goes on and says, the Midianites ranged over a wide area of the Near East, stretching from the eastern shore of the Gulf of Aqaba. So if you're thinking, think of a map, think of the Red Sea. It has those two prongs. The left prong, you know, sort of points toward the delta region of Egypt. The right prong, that's the Gulf of Aqaba. And to the east of that, on the other side of that watery prong, is what is now, you know, Saudi Arabia. It's that, that prong, you know, sort of delimits, in modern terms, the you know, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. You've got Jordan as well, also referred to as the, you know, the Arabian Peninsula, that idea. So Sarna is saying Midian as a land stretches from the eastern shore of the Gulf of Aqaba, so that right-hand prong eastward, up through the Syro-Arabian Desert, which again is going to be the Arabian Peninsula, Saudi Arabia today, Jordan, and into the borders of the land of Israel, west and northwest of Eilat. Eilat is right sort of at the tip of that right prong. If you're looking at a map, again, that right prong of the Red Sea. So north and northwest obviously would take us into the land of Israel, probably not as far as Bashan, but maybe the lower region of Bashan. I mean, who knows precisely how this would have been defined. It's just, again, general territory. So we can't, you know, take this as evidence, again, that Moses has fled into giant clan territory. I mean, it's possible, but it's more likely that there was some sort of overlordship relationship between the king of the Amorites, you know, Sion and Og, and the Midianite confederation, you know, that the latter was somehow subservient or answerable to the former. So let me just throw in one other thing, because we're going to get into, you probably already have sort of picked up on it. This is going to directly relate to the location of Mount Sinai, okay, the location of the burning bush incident, which we'll actually get into more next week when we hit Exodus 3, because that's the passage for it. But we'll say a few things about it in this episode. But I want to add what Anchor Yale Bible Dictionary says here about Midian. I'll just read you the selection here. The origin of the name Midian is unknown, though it has been suggested that the root Madi is non-Semitic and possibly cognate to the designation of Medes of much later times. The biblical genealogy, and he references, the writer references Genesis 25:2. The biblical genealogy includes two variants, Midian and Midan, cognates of both of which appear in Greek sources of the Hellenistic period as names of towns east of the Gulf of Aqaba. So there's that location again, east of the Gulf of Aqaba, over in what we would now think Saudi Arabia, you know, and then a little bit north of that, you know, Jordan. Biblical tradition listed the eponymous ancestor Midian as one of six sons born to the patriarch Abraham by his second wife, Keturah. That's Genesis 25:1-6. So again, that's what the writer was referring to by the biblical genealogy of the name Midian. It shows up in Genesis 25:1-6, specifically verse 2, as one of the six sons born to Abraham by Keturah. Back to the quotation. According to this account, Abraham sent these sons away from Canaan to the east country, a tradition that implies an origin in Canaan proper for these proto-Arabic tribal designations. This tradition is now powerfully reinforced by linguistic evidence that derives the pre-Islamic Arabic language and writing system from the Bronze Age Mediterranean coastal region. So there's a connection linguistically between Arabic before the advent of Islam, and, you know, that language and languages that, again, are closer to the Mediterranean coast, which of course would be Canaan proper. So the linguistic evidence backs up this notion of Genesis 25:1-6 as far as you know, having a Canaan or Canaanite origin for the people of Midian. And again, through, in biblical terms, through Abraham and Keturah. Now, on continuing on with Anchor Yale Bible Dictionary, it takes what I guess is fair to say, a liberal bent when it comes to some of this material. I'll just read it to you. The Midianites as a historically existent society are represented in the Joseph stories, Genesis 37, 25 through 36, as traders traveling by camel caravan. The Midianites as a historically existent society are represented, again, in this passage, as this caravan traveling between Gilead, which is the northern part of the Transjordan, the other side of the Jordan, and Egypt. And in this case, dealing in slaves as well as gum, balm, and myrrh. The term Midianite alternates with the term Ishmaelite in that passage. Probably to be explained, here's the liberal bent, at least a little bit, probably to be explained by the fact that at the time the narrative reached its present form, the Midianites had ceased to exist as a distinct social group, but were identified with an ethnic group later called Ishmaelites. The narrative certainly is not earlier than the monarchy, time of Saul, David, and Solomon, and there's no reason to believe it is based upon any historical event. Now, that's from Anchor Yale Bible Dictionary. It's by Mendenhall again, and he's sort of playing his hand as far as his view of the historicity of the text. That's why I said a liberal bent. Now, Sarna, back in his, this is actually a different commentary. He is a Jewish Publication Society commentary on Exodus, which we've quoted from before, and we did a few minutes ago. And he also has the Genesis volume. Now, here's what he says in the Genesis volume. He's a little more charitable than Mendenhall is in the Anchor Yale Bible Dictionary. So in talking about the discrepancy between Midianites interchanged with Ishmaelites, because again, if the Midianites came from Abraham through Keturah back in Genesis 25, then how can we possibly call them Ishmaelites? Because Ishmael is born by Hagar. So we have a disconnection here, a problem. And Mendenhall's solution is that, well, this is not historical anyway, and it's probably because the Midianites ceased to be a people by the time this was written, and they just got conflated by mistake, so on and so forth. Sarna is a little more generous. He writes this, "The discrepancy in names has been variously explained by traditional commentators. Genesis Rabbah, 84:20, and this is rabbinic stuff, so that's what he means by traditional commentators. Genesis Rabbah 84:20, followed by Rashi, postulates that Joseph was traded several times. Ibn Ezra identifies the Ishmaelites with Midianites on the basis of Judges 8:24, and I'll read that. Gideon said to him, 'Let me make a request of you. Every one of you give me the earrings from his spoil, for they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites.'" Remember, Gideon was connected with the Midianites, okay? So I'll repeat that. Ibn Ezra identifies the Ishmaelites with Midianites on the basis of Judges 8:24, which relates that Midianites possessed golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. This passage suggests that the term Ishmaelite was used as an epithet for nomadic traders rather than in an ethnic sense. Midianite, on the other hand, indicates a specific ethnic affiliation. Even if the two names are indicative of originally distinct narrative strands that have here been interwoven, it must have been the close connection between Ishmael and Midian in biblical tradition, both being offspring of Abraham, again by different women, that led to their fusion. That's the end of the Sarna quote. So again, he doesn't see this as any indication of it not being historical. So again, he's more charitable than Mendenhall was in Anchor Yale Bible Dictionary. The point here is that Moses is a distant relative of the Midianites before he gets married to Zipporah, okay? Before he meets, you know, Jethro or Reuel. We'll talk about those names in a moment. Moses is already something of a distant relative because Moses is, from the line of Isaac and Jacob back to Abraham. He's an Israelite. So there's some connection already, or some family connection. Back to verse 15, Moses goes to Midian. As I mentioned before, you know, this is going to take us into the burning bush encounter, this location of Sinai, all this kind of stuff. So I'll just sort of telegraph this a little bit, deal with it a little bit, because we're going to actually return, you know, to this topic in other places, you know, in the book of Exodus in the series. So in Exodus 3:1, let's just look at Exodus 3:1, because right after our portion for today, Exodus 2:11 through 25, you know, Moses is in Midian, he flees to Midian, he gets married, he's got Jethro, your Reuel, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. Then the very next verse, Exodus 3:1, says, "Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro, the priest of Midian. and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. So Exodus 3:1 is typically read as though Moses is tending Jethro's flocks in Midian. And so the assumption is that the mountain of God in Exodus 3:1, which is named there as Horeb, seems to be in Midian. Now, you could read the verse that way, and some do, but the verse could also be read in a different way. Okay, think about it. I'm going to read it again. Now, Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. The verse could very obviously be read that Moses left Midian and journeyed to the west of Midian, or a wilderness west of Midian. In other words, Exodus 3:1 doesn't actually tell us with certainty that the mountain of God, Horeb, is in Midian. You can't really use that verse for it. Because if you read the verse, Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro. Now, Jethro certainly is the priest of Midian. Okay, we got that. But he led Jethro's flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb. So Horeb could very well be perceived and actually be to the west of Midian, somewhere where it wasn't in Midian proper. Of course, the difficulty here is, well, how do we define Midian with any precision? Because it could be this territory of east of the Gulf of Aqaba, all the way up north, you know, to where you hit Eilat, and even beyond that into Canaan territory. You know, how do we know this specifically? Now, I mentioned this. You can't read that, I think. This is just my opinion. I mean, I used to be on this bandwagon that Mount Sinai or Horeb, and again, we have to deal with that as well. What's with the two names? I used to be on the bandwagon that Mount Sinai was in Midian, you know, specifically, you know, Jebel Allah's. I'm not anymore. I think it's possible, but it has some serious, there are serious uncertainties with it and problems with it. And frankly, the evidence used popularly to support the idea is, it ranges from anything from something contrived to just being weak and iffy. It's just far from secure. Let's put it that way. There are some significant problems with it. I think, you know, we can leave the door open to it. But certainly you can't take this Midian language and go, you know, take a flock and go all the way west of the Gulf of Aqaba, all the way down to the traditional Sinai. This is hundreds and hundreds of miles, you know, through arid desert country to hit the traditional site of Sinai. I don't see how Exodus 3:1 can really be reconciled with the traditional site. But what people fail to realize is there are actually more than two candidates for Sinai. It's not just a choice between the traditional Mount Sinai at Jebel Musa and Jebel Allah's in Midian or Saudi Arabia. There are other possible locations. They just don't get the press. And there are certain passages of scripture that would frankly rule out both the traditional site and a location in Midian, but would actually work well if you're talking about territory that's just to the north or northwest of the Gulf of Aqaba, the tip there, you know, Eilat. There are other candidates here. So again, that's kind of as far as I really want to, you know, get into that specific subject. We'll hit it again as we're going through Exodus, but I'm just, you know, putting those cards on the table that, you know, I used to think a lot more highly of the Mount Sinai in Arabia idea than I do now. It does have serious weaknesses, but the traditional view also has some pretty serious weaknesses too. But there are other possibilities. Before we leave that, I mentioned about the names Horeb and Sinai. Now, what I just read in Exodus 3:1, it takes us into other questions. You know, what's the relationship of Midian to Horeb? Because is Horeb in Midian or is it to the west of Midian? If as you read the verse, you can read it that way. And then also, what's the relationship of Horeb to Sinai? Here's a significant passage. I'm just going to read you this. And without getting into it, because it's in Exodus 17, you know, we'll hit it at some point, you know, in the course of the podcast. But Exodus 17:1 through 7 says this: all the congregation of the people of Israel moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages, according to the commandment of the Lord, and they camped at Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water, and the people grumbled against Moses and said, "Why did you bring us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" So Moses cried to the Lord, "What shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me." And the Lord said to Moses, "Pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go, and behold, I will..." Now catch this line. This is Exodus 17:6. "Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water shall come out of it, and the people will drink." And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. And he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah because of the quarreling of the people of Israel, because they tested the Lord by saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" So this event occurs at Horeb. And if you keep reading Exodus 17, they're only going to get to Sinai just, you know, right around Exodus 20, you know, in Exodus 19. They have a ways to go before they get to the place where they get the law. So here we have a disconnection. It's a clear disconnection between the mountain, you know, or Horeb, just the term Horeb, and the mountain of God that they're going to end up at. So that's another issue for when we're trying to determine, or at least come up with an idea of, you know, where Mount Sinai is. Exodus 3:1 links the two, and it's not the only passage that is linked, that links Horeb and Sinai. And then there you have other passages like this one that clearly distinguish them as separate locations. Now, Sarna comments on this. He says, "Many texts seem to identify this location." He's commenting on Exodus 3:1, Horeb. "Many texts seem to identify this location with Sinai, but there are also indications that they may not be identical. Thus, while Mount Sinai appears frequently, Mount Horeb is rare. And there's no reference to the wilderness of Horeb as there is to that of Sinai. Further, an impression of some distance between the two is gained from the story of the water crisis at Rephidim, as told in Exodus 17:1 through 7. There, the divine spirit is said to have been manifest before Moses, close by a rock at Horeb. Yet Rephidim was the last station of the Israelites before entering the wilderness of Sinai. We may be dealing with different strands or different tradition. Or Horeb may have been the name of a wider region in which Mount Sinai, a specific peak, was located. Perhaps that peak eventually lent its name to the entire area. Horeb means desolate or dry, and its location has not been identified. So again, we're going to hit all this again when we get into Exodus 3, but you should know, even at this point, that we've got some problems here. Between Midian, you know, what is it? How wide is it? Where does it go? Where does it stop? You know, that kind of thing. Like, or does it have borders? Sinai, Horeb, again, all these place names. There is variability, and there just isn't agreement. So we have to think about, well, what do the terms mean in which context and why and all that sort of stuff. The location of Sinai, again, is not a simple thing. So if someone tells you it is a simple thing, that all you got to do is look at this or do that, it just isn't. It just isn't. There's just more to it than that, that a close reading of Scripture is going to take you into some of these problem areas. And if you don't deal with them, you're really not dealing with the subject, you know, very well anyway. So let's move on. In verse 16, we want to, you know, keep going here in Exodus chapter 2. In verse 16, we read, "Now the priest of Midian had 7 daughters." Then in verse 18, we read, "When those daughters came home to their father, Reuel." And then in verse 21, we read about the priest of Midian named Reuel becomes Moses' father-in-law. But in Exodus 3:1, which we just read, it is Jethro who is Moses' father-in-law, and he is explicitly called the priest of Midian. So what's going on here? I mean, who is Moses' father-in-law? Is it Reuel? Is it Jethro? Who's the priest of Midian? Is it one of these two guys? You know, why the different names? it's actually going to get worse because you're going to have a third name thrown in certain passages. This is a well-known historical problem, historical textual problem in the book and elsewhere. So I'm going to read from P.E. Hughes's article in the Dictionary of the Old Testament of the Pentateuch, just to give you some flavor for it, again, for how scholars, some scholars at least, approach it. He writes, "The priest of Midian of Exodus 2:16 is called Reuel in Exodus 2:18, but referred to as Jethro in a number of places, Exodus 18:1, we could put in Exodus 3:1, 18:1, 2, 5, 6, 9, 10, and 12. In addition, Judges 4:11, in that passage, mention is made of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses." You got three. I'll just read you that verse. This is Judges 4:11. "Now Heber, the Kenite, had separated from the Kenites, the descendants of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, and had pitched his tent as far away as the oak of Zaananim, which is near Kadesh." So, okay, now we got three. Now, what are we supposed to do? Back to Hughes. Hughes says, "Cumulatively, not only is Moses' father-in-law given the three names of Reuel, Jethro, and Hobab, but the latter does not align with Numbers 10:29, which describes Hobab as the son of Reuel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law." It's just starting to sound like I'm my own grandpa now, the old folk song. Back to Hughes. "Different proposals have been presented to solve this dilemma, from source critical solutions, like Jethro is the guy for the E document, the E, right, the JEDB thing. Jethro is in the E source, Moses' father-in-law, and Reuel and Hobab belong to the J document. And this is why they're mixed, because the Pentateuch is just a mixture of these different documents. The editor just goofed here or whatever." Again, that's sort of a standard source critical approach. So Hughes says, one of the approaches is to try to refer to source critical solutions. We also have, back to Hughes, we also have the suggestion that a misreading of the Numbers passage may have influenced the identification of Jethro as Hobab in Judges. So again, then we'd have an error in Judges. To the proposition that we may be missing fine distinctions between personal and clan names, that's the third option. Some have proposed that we're just missing some fine distinctions between personal names and clan names. This latter perspective was advanced by W.F. Albright, who concluded that Reuel was a clan name and Jethro was his proper name, with the seeming reference to the same person in Numbers 10, 29 through 32, attributed to him by a misvocalization in the Hebrew text. So Albright's solution is, look, one of these is a clan name, the other one is a personal name, a proper name, and Numbers 10, 29 through 32 confuses things because the Hebrew text, some scribe at some point put the wrong vowels to the consonants. Remember, the consonants were are the things that were, the original part of the composition, and vowels were added much later. So Albright notes that if you look at the Hebrew there, you can read the Hebrew term as kotein, son-in-law of Moses, as opposed to father-in-law, which would get a different pronunciation. So this was Albright's solution. Sarna, we'll bring him into the picture, in his Exodus commentary, writes this. Reuel is mentioned once again in Numbers 10:29, where he quotes, Hobab, son of Reuel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law. And again, Albright's saying it could be son-in-law, depending on what vowels you give it. Sarna says, Reuel is mentioned once again in Numbers 10:29, where it's uncertain which of the two is so designated. So Sarna points out that if you actually read Numbers 10:29, Hobab, son of Reuel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law, you can't actually tell which one is Moses' father-in-law. It could be Hobab, it could be Reuel. I mean, it just depends on syntactically how you take that. It's the relationship of the order, the word order here with the semantics. So he says, it's uncertain which of the two is so designated. Sarna continues, from Judges 4:11, it would appear that Hobab is the father-in-law, but in other texts, this latter epithet is given to Jethro. So Hobab and Jethro, two different names, who also bears the title priest of Midian. Sarna notes, rabbinic exegesis reconciles the discrepancies by assuming that Reuel was the grandfather of the girls and that the other names all refer to the same person who bore several names. many modern scholars prefer to assign the variants to different strands of tradition. However, it is to be noted that the title Priest of Midian is only explicitly attached to Jethro. This raises the possibility that Hebrew Yitro, or Yeter, is not a proper name, but an honorific name, meaning something like His Excellency. And as a biblical parallel, he points to Genesis 49:3. I'm going to read you that verse. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the first fruits of my strength. Preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power. The word preeminent there, occurring twice in the same verse, is the word Yeter in Hebrew. It's the same, you know, that you'll find in passages for Jethro. And so Sarna is suggesting that Jethro really isn't a proper name. We should probably understand it as something of an honorific title, like His Excellency. And he further bolsters that by appealing to Akkadian. He says, in Akkadian, Atru, think about it, Yitro, Hebrew, Atru, Akkadian, they sound very much alike. Akkadian is East Semitic, Hebrew is Northwest Semitic. In Akkadian, Atru or Watru means preeminent or foremost, which would be very basically the same as the what we just read in Genesis 49, verse 3. In addition, several old Akkadian names begin with that element. They begin with Atru, again, which to Sarna suggests we have an honorific title here, like Sir or His Excellency. You know, like, oh, I hate to use George. Well, George Washington is a good illustration. Right? That's how George Washington was referred to, His Excellency George Washington, or His Excellency, you know, President George Washington, something like that. It was a title that Washington actually, you know, later on, when they were talking about what to call the leader of the nation, he didn't want to be called His Excellency because it sounded like too much like kingship. So President, you know, was what they decided on. But this is the way Washington was referred to routinely. So it could be a similar idea. Lastly, Sarna points out in Ugaritic, several personal nouns are known that are prefixed by the element YTR, exactly the same as Hebrew, Yeter or Yitro. So that's the end of Sarna's contribution there. So it's very possible that the way to reconcile this information is just as we tried to summarize there, that you might have a confusion between son-in-law and father-in-law in the one passage. Just depends on what vowels you apply to the Hebrew consonants. You could have Jethro as a title akin to His Excellency. And again, these elements remove the obstacles, remove the contradictions. You're not forced to say, well, these passages are what they are because they're hopelessly contradictory because some editor goofed up when he was making the Pentateuch from these three different documents or two different documents, you know, J and E. You don't have to go there. You know, for some, that's just an easy solution because, again, they're committed intellectually, you know, to the JEDP idea. And again, I'm not an opponent of editing. I don't buy JEDP because I do think it's based on circular reasoning, as I've said many times on the podcast. But editing certainly, you know, happens throughout Scripture, including the Torah. But we don't need to appeal to that sort of thing when we, you know, actually have a fairly not only reasonable, but fairly easy solution here, repointing Hebrew, because again, the vowels were not original. And then looking at other occurrences of this Hebrew lemma, Yeter, and seeing not only in Hebrew, in the Hebrew Bible, but also in Akkadian and Ugaritic, that it refers to some sort of preeminence idea of for a person. So the idea that it's an honorific title, that could make pretty good sense. Other items here. Let's talk about the name Ruel. Some of you, again, have already tracked on this as hearing that term, you're going to be on this point already. The name means friend of God. El is the generic term for God. The other part is the word for friend or companion. Friend of God or maybe friend of El. Although Nauf in Anchor Yale Bible Dictionary writes this. He says, the name means friend of God or God is friend. El in personal names does not necessarily refer to the god El. And he's right. He's right about that. So just because it's El doesn't mean it's a proper name. That's completely fair. And again, Nauf isn't a card-carrying evangelical by any means. For those of you listening, think that presume that these sorts of discussions sort of default to some sort of evangelical censoring, then you're wrong. Listen to more of the podcast and you'll see how wrong that is. Again, we're just going with you know, good scholarship here. Could mean either, but it doesn't have to mean L. You know, there's nothing wrong with it specifically because of some of the things we're going to get into here, you know, about, you know, going back to the Midianites and their ancestry and all that stuff. So it could be El, but that doesn't mean El was perceived as a different deity than the one that Moses is going to encounter again at the burning bush and later. So Anchor Yale Bible Dictionary says this, and again, this is Nauf's article on that particular entry, Reuel. He says, Reuel is a son of Esau. Again, in one, at least one Reuel, this is where the name shows up. Can you be used of a son of Esau, Genesis 36, 4, verse 10, 13, 17, 1 Chronicles 1, 35, and 37. If the list of Genesis 36, 10 through 14 reflects the structure of the Edomite tribal system in the 7th century BC, then Reuel was one of the three major Edomite tribes and had four sub-tribes, in Genesis 36, 10 through 14. And again, that would be no surprise because Esau is identified with Edom in Genesis 36 and elsewhere. Nauf continues, in Numbers 10:29, Reuel is the father of Hobab, the eponymous ancestor of a Kenite clan that settled in the Negev among the tribe of Judah. This clan may well have belonged to the Edomite tribe Reuel before it migrated to the other side of Wadi Arabah. Therefore, Reuel, as Moses' relative, is possibly identical with the Edomite tribe. And he references Albright here, who, you know, sort of went along the same trajectory. Now, the point of all that is that it's possible. It's quite possible that Moses, therefore, represents both lines, you know, from Isaac, both of Isaac's lines, Jacob's line, because Moses is from Levi. And again, if you have this connection here with Esau, you know, Isaac had two sons, Jacob and Esau. Moses is sort of emblematic and has some sort of blood connection with both sides, as well as being a distant relative of the Midianites who overlap with the Ishmaelites. And again, there you have Abraham's seed outside the line of Isaac, which is really kind of interesting. I mean, the person Moses could represent all of the two lines within the one, you know, Abrahamic line, and then the line in another Abrahamic line. It's just kind of interesting genealogically. Now, Carpenter writes, you know, that, you know, given the lineages involved, it seems, Carpenter says, it seems likely that the Midianites would have known of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but not by the name Yahweh as revealed to Moses in the third chapter of Exodus. I mean, Exodus 3, God is going to reveal this name to Moses. In other words, it's quite coherent. This is me now. This isn't Carpenter. It's quite coherent to think that these people, the Midianites, knew of and worshipped the God of their patriarchal forefathers. Yeah, that's perfectly compatible with what we're reading and what we know of them genealogically. It would be reasonable, you know, because you have, again, all these lineages going back to Abraham and Isaac. Again, Isaac having the two lines, Jacob and Esau, that these people would have known about the God of their forefathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And again, that doesn't necessarily mean that they knew that God by the name Yahweh. Because if we take Exodus 3 seriously, and, you know, Exodus 6:3 is another allusion to this, then, you know, God's revealing something to Moses at the burning bush. I am that I am. I am who I am. Okay, and we'll talk about the meaning of the name when we get to Exodus 3 in the podcast. But if that's, you know, if they already knew that, it wouldn't be a revelation to Moses. Well, it was a revelation. And he's, you know, he's identifying in Exodus 3, the same passage, you know, with the people in Egypt and their forefathers, you know, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I mean, it's the same deity. Now, you know, people who are listening to this are going to think, well, that's just kind of weird because in my English Bible, you know, I read the name Yahweh in passages before Exodus 3 and some passages that have to do with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I read, you know, the Lord, it's Yahweh there. That's correct. You do. And here's where, again, this is actually where the source critical approach to the Torah really started. because you have revelations of the divine name in Exodus 3, and then when you have the same divine name supposedly revealed in Exodus 3 to Moses at the burning bush, you have it show up elsewhere in the Old Testament with earlier patriarchs. Some people looked at that and thought, well, that just doesn't make sense. The Pentateuch must be, therefore, a combination of different documents where you had one person writing about God using the name Yahweh, another person writing about God using El or El derivatives like El Shaddai or something like that, and that somebody came along, again, in Israelite or Jewish tradition, and he wove these two things together into one cohesive narrative, and he mixed the names. Again, this is the core of the Mosaic authorship issue. J and E documents, D is something else, P is something else. Okay, but this is where it actually begins because of issues like this. So we've run right into it. Now, again, you don't have to embrace the entirety of the JEDP idea to accept this. Again, I'm what used to be called a supplementarian. I believe there was a Mosaic core. I believe we have material composed or heavily edited in Babylon, Genesis 1 through 11. I believe we have other material derived or that gets codified, put in writing from oral tradition of the people, you know, ancient people of Israel themselves. They knew these stories about their ancestors, and eventually those stories got written down. And yes, you do have editorial evidence where you have it at some places. An editor must have used the divine name Yahweh in earlier scenes, earlier episodes, specifically so that his readers would understand that we're not dealing with two deities here, specifically. In other words, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob would have known God by El and El names. Good. They're worshiping one God, okay? The God, singular, of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And when you get to Moses, Moses, you know, encounters this same God who reveals to him another name, and he's going to relate to Moses by a different name. Well, the patriarchs didn't know that, but it doesn't matter because they're the same deity. But whoever is reading the Hebrew Bible centuries later sees and understands that both he and his own readers, you know, as he's, you know, putting the final touches on this thing that we're going to call the Torah, and wider than that, the Tanakh, sees the need to make sure his readers understand that these names all lead to the same place, all lead to the same deity. And so an editor would insert the subsequent name, the covenant name, the, you know, Yahweh. He will put that into passages so that his readers understand that it's the same God. It's the same entity, the same deity, the same person. This is the way you would do it. You tie those threads together. Now, you can do that without having the Pentateuch be, you know, in terms of its origin, be completely, you know, created out of four different documents. Again, my view, and again, it's a minority view now. It used to be a majority view back in the day, is that you have a substantial element of oral tradition from the Israelites, the Hebrews. You have Moses writing material, and then that stuff gets edited later, gets accrued to, and it gets edited later. See, JEDP, what JEDP really wanted to deny was any sense of Mosaic authorship. That's really what it was after. That's what was in the crosshairs. You know, and once you do that, you don't have a need for Moses. And they were questioning even the existence of Moses and so on and so forth. So that's really what that was about. It wasn't about trying necessarily to come up with a better way to understand why we have the Torah and let Moses be a contributor. See, that's the supplementarian position that I hold. I don't see any reason why Moses could not have been a substantial contributor to what we call the Torah. But if you're a JEDP guy, you don't say that at all. Even evangelicals who buy into JEDP, again, Moses didn't have anything to do with this as far as composition. He's the subject of a lot of it, but as far as composition, he had nothing to do with it. And they'll still affirm the historicity of Moses, but he didn't touch the thing. I think that's too extreme. And ultimately, the way JEDP is articulated and defended, it does fall prey to circular reasoning at points. Again, I've talked about this before and blogged about it, so I don't want to, you know, keep going down this road. But this is a really good example where, you know, you've got this situation. You just run into it in the text. So again, there's nothing, you know, back up to the major point for our purposes. It's completely coherent that the Midianites, if they're Edomites or Ishmaelites or, you know, whateverites, okay, that this people group, that Moses finds himself in their midst. It's completely coherent that this group would have worshipped the God that Moses worshipped while he was living in Egypt, and his people, the God of their ancestors, because that same God is their God too. All these other ancestors, these other people groups, you know, we know that by virtue of the genealogical comments that I've read here, you know, in the course of discussing the topic here. It's not unreasonable to say, you know, to have this picture. So Moses wanders into Midian, and they know who the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is. It's interesting. When you get to Exodus 4, remember the famous or infamous bridegroom of blood episode where God, you know, wants to kill Moses, and then Zipporah has to save the day, and there's something going on, you know, with circumcision. Again, we'll get to that too. But she knows. She's the daughter of the priest of Midian. She knows that circumcision is a big deal. Again, that's right out of the religion of the patriarchs. So again, it's very consistent. It's very consistent, even though, again, it requires us to think a little bit differently about some things. Now, to wrap up our episode, just a couple of other things. Let's look at Zipporah. In verse 21, her name means bird, a bird. Again, it's either a term of endearment or to reflect, you know, her beauty. Verse 22, we get Gershom. Gershom has an interesting meaning. You know, Zipporah gives birth to a son. Moses, called his name Gershom, for he said, "I have been a sojourner in a foreign land." Gershom, again, comes from the main stem of the word is garash, which means to drive out or to drive off. Okay, it's the same lemma used to describe the action of the shepherds in verse 17. Okay, when the daughters of the priest of Midian, you know, are being driven off, you know, the shepherds came and drove them away. It's the same lemma there, garash, to drive away. And it's kind of interesting that Moses, of course, witnesses this while he's in a foreign land, and he has been driven out of Egypt. Again, he's forced to flee, you know, by Pharaoh. So just the name of the son sort of harkens back to the occasion where Moses met his future wife and he was received into Jethro's family. But Gershom, Sarna points out, also carries a wider national allusiveness. That's A-L-L, like an allusion. Its allusions are bigger. For later in the narrative, the stem is used three more times. Garash is used three more times to underscore the abject humiliation of the stubborn Pharaoh as he is forced to reverse his refusal to let Israel go. Again, later on in the story, again, he drives them out. You know, in other words, the term's going to be picked up by the writer just to draw connections between Moses being driven away and Moses rescuing these women from the shepherds. Shepherds who were driving them away, and then of course the name of Moses' own son. There's an interconnectedness, you know, throughout these characters and these scenes. The folk etymology, Sarna says, interprets the name as a composite of Ger Sham, a stranger. There, Ger is stranger. Sham is the word for there. And so we get this, I've been a sojourner in a foreign land. That statement is still true because Moses was driven out. But again, scholars have pointed out that what we actually have here is the lemma garash, to drive out. And it's used intertextually in a number of you know, other episodes here. Verses 23 through 24, or the end, through 25, we read, during those many days, the king of Egypt died. There, you know, again, when we were discussing chronology earlier, you cannot say that you have the same Pharaoh who was the Pharaoh of the oppression and the one who was seeking Moses' life and have the same guy be the Pharaoh of the Exodus, because he dies. Right here it is. Again, I don't want to rehearse that, but this is something that needs to be accounted for, and it's kind of astonishing how many treatments of the chronology, the candidate for Pharaoh, just omit this or just never seem to see it. Again, I don't know how that is, but it's true. I can show you specific examples of you know, pretty good published stuff, and it just, it's not in there. They're, you know, continuing in Exodus 2 in verse 23. So the king of Egypt died. The people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. That's the way it ends. And God knew. He knew what? I mean, haven't you ever wondered that? You get to the end of Exodus 2, and God knew. What? I mean, it feels like there's something that should come after that. The best answer is probably found in Exodus 3, 7 through 8a, at least the first part of A, because it aligns with the third-person narration of Exodus 2, 23 through 24. So if we read Exodus 3, 7, and 8, then the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know, and here we get what God knows, I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and bring them out of that land, so on and so forth. So what God knows is what's happening to his people. And that's what we read, you know, in Exodus 2, 23 and 24. It's just odd that verse 25 ends that way. God saw the people of Israel and God knew. It's really abrupt, but that, you know, that's what it is. Now, as far as literary stuff, and we'll end with this, I mean, we've sort of, you know, picked around a few of the problems in the passage and a few of the things that we're going to, you know, be picking up in later episodes with Exodus 3 and beyond. But there's some real interesting literary things going on. I just want to read a summary by Hughes in the Dictionary of the Old Testament Pentateuch. I think he has a really nice way of summarizing kind of literarily what's going on in this passage. He writes, Reuel's significance is further emphasized by the fact that he is properly named Reuel, meaning friend of God. In Exodus 2:18, which provides a sharp contrast to the oppressive anti-creational bent of the Pharaoh, who has just been described as seeking to kill Moses. So Reuel, the friend of God, God's companion, is set in contrast to Pharaoh. You know, one is the friend of God and the friend of Moses, the other one wants to kill him. The hospitality of the priest toward Moses, the outsider, not only contrasts with Pharaoh and his banishment to Moses from Egypt, but also serves to illustrate the impending legal concern for upholding the cause of those on the margins of Israelite society. Again, Carpenter gets into the foreshadowing of all this. He writes this, the conclusion in verse 22 and the previous context, including Genesis 15, 13 and Genesis 50, 24 through 25. Again, verse 22 is the reference to Gershom. And that Moses was a sojourner, a stranger in a foreign land. These things work together to indicate Moses' status in Midian is ultimately temporary, and to anticipate an open door for him to return to Egypt to lead Israel to their own land of inheritance. The event of Moses' deliverance, think of the word deliverance. The event of Moses' deliverance of Reuel's daughters foreshadows not only Exodus 18, but the entire episode in Exodus 18, 1 through 12. In incipient form, it is Moses who informs Reuel or Jethro of Yahweh in chapter 18, not the other way around. This scenario involving meeting one's bride at a well recalls similar scenes in Genesis 24, 12 through 16 with Isaac and Rebekah, Genesis 29, 1 through 14 with Jacob and Rachel. All of these episodes stress the providential care of God for the persons involved. But in this case, it is Moses' exile and sojourn in Midian that is the most important. Moses' act of kindness had ramifications that he did not expect, but the reader will recall that he had been a favored baby, Exodus 2:2, a status that also applies to him as an adult. That special status is revealed powerfully in the functions God places on Moses, God's chosen leader. And that's the end of the quote. Again, what he's saying here is that the whole thing, Moses winds up in Midian. Again, you've got the association with Zion, you've got the kings of Midian. He's running from Pharaoh, but what happens to him? He runs into the friend of God, Reuel, and he is taken in by that family. He delivers, okay? He delivers, and the word there is the same as you're going to get, you know, with deliverance elsewhere in the Exodus story, but he delivers the women from these hostile shepherds who are driving them away from the water. And it foreshadows the deliverance that Moses is going to be the agent of for the entire nation. And really, it foreshadows even more than that, you know, with the salvation of God's people, you know, later on in the New Testament. You know, he is a stranger, you know, in a foreign land. He's been driven out, and he refers to the driving out. I mean, all these things are to make you connect in your mind Moses, Egypt, Midian, Reuel, all those things with what's going to happen later. Specific episodes, specific deliverances, specific places, specific people, you know, ultimately that Moses is going to be involved in. So there are these little seed words and seed thoughts in the last few verses, really 16 through 20, 25 of Exodus 2, that sort of set the stage. They become little springboards or little, you know, jumping off points for the story as it's going to unfold later on, because some of the same verbiage is going to be used. You'll have seen it before, and it'll take your mind back here in some clever ways. So I just wanted to throw that in because, again, I like intertextuality. If you don't, well, I'm sorry. But I like intertextuality because, again, the biblical writers are intelligent. They drop things, little breadcrumbs, words, phrases, imagery, because they want you to connect ideas in the present, what you're reading. And they also want you to remember them when you get to other places in what they're writing, and you can see how one thing foreshadowed the other. I think it's just interesting to be able to trace those things through. So next time, we will hit Exodus 3. We've got a lot to talk about, you know, Horeb, Sinai, Midian, the revealing of the name. Again, there's a lot of stuff there that we've sort of seen the precursor of already here. And it's not going to be unique to Exodus. There's going to be a lot of that going on in the book.
All right, Mike. And also, we're going to be splitting chapter 3 into two parts.
Yeah, it'll be at least two. I'm not sure how it's going to be, but I'd like to cover the first 14 verses next time. We'll see how far we get.
All right, Mike. Well, we appreciate it. Looking forward to chapter 3 next week. And I just want to thank everybody else for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.